We're talking about race in the military here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A milestone last week, the Air Force's new Chief of Staff, General C.Q. Brown Jr., was sworn in, becoming the first African-American general to lead a branch of the U.S. military. In June, he reflected on the injustices he's experienced in his military service.
I'm thinking about wearing the same flight suit with the same wings on my chest as my peers, and then being questioned by another military member, "Are you a pilot?"
Have you been questioned like this before or been doubted based on the color of your skin? How would you describe your military service and interactions with your superiors and your fellow troops? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dana Pittard is a retired major general in the U.S. Army, one of the few African Americans to rise to this rank. And during his 34 years of service, he fought in Iraq. He was awarded 4 Bronze Stars. He oversaw training of Iraqi forces as deputy commander for operations in the Middle East. Major General Pittard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with where you started and how you decided to go into the military, because you had a long career in the military. What led you to enlist?
Well, I came from an Army family. My father served in the military. He retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Army, but he started out as a young private in 1950 and went to Officer at Kennedy School. And so I think in some ways it was in my blood. I think as early as 5 years old, I wanted to go into the military. But I decided to at least strive to go to West Point after seeing a National Geographic magazine in July 1969 of President Eisenhower. And there was this one photograph that just hit me. And it was President Dwight D. Eisenhower as General Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe prior to D-Day, with all these maps behind him. He was at this big table, and sitting next to him were Field Marshal Montgomery, General Bradley, Air Marshal Tedder. And I was so impressed with that. I said, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. Of course, that was like 1969. And I asked my parents, called a meeting of our family and said, I want to go to West Point. Well, at that time, there was only a handful of African-Americans that had even gone to West Point. My father and mother, they didn't laugh, to their credit. And they said, okay, if that's what you want to do. I was in the fourth grade. Mm. And then 8 years later, I entered West Point.
How was race discussed within your family? What did your father tell you?
Oh, I mean, it was certainly all around us because, grew up in the 1960s and 1970s. So both my parents worked. My mother was a Department of the Army civilian and a mathematics teacher. And my father, like I said, was an officer in the Army. So we always talked about that. They're both very patriotic to our country. But there's also some things that we're aware of all around us, even in the second grade. I remember being called up to the principal's office. We were living on an Air Force base. It was an elementary school outside of Air Force base outside of Kansas City. And I had called the principal's office because every morning he said Pledge of Allegiance. And I didn't say the words Injustice for All at the end. Because even then, it was 1966 at that time, I knew that it wasn't just for certainly African Americans. And my father had to come get me at the principal's office. He gave me the discussion. He said, but we got to work within the system. You know, my father later ran for president of the PTA there and made some changes. But again, even at that young age, I was aware of discrepancies in our country.
We're talking with Dana Pittard, a major general in the U.S. Army, retired, spent 34 years in service before retiring in 2015, and we're talking about race in the military. You can join in. Have you experienced racism as a person of color in military service? What can you do to think what can be done about this issue in the military? How can we work to eradicate racism in the military? Is it even possible? Join in to the discussion, 800-642-1234. When you arrived at West Point, you got in. You got into West Point. What was it like in those early days? What was your fresh first impressions?
My first impression was, wow, yeah, I'd been wanting to come here for 8 years, but I didn't really know what I was getting into. It's a wonderful school and institution. It really is a leadership factory in so many ways. And I thrived. That's what I wanted to do. And so the camaraderie between classmates was very, very strong, I thought. But there are people from all around the country. I had been in high school. I went to a large high school. In fact, at the time, it was like the third largest high school in Texas, there in El Paso, Texas, almost 5,000 students. I was a student body president. So I thought I was, all that. But you got to West Point, there were, a dime a dozen. There was former student body presidents, valedictorians, captains of football teams, you name it. It was an amazing melting of folks from all over the country. But again, West Point is a reflection of the society in which, we serve. People brought in their biases, their prejudices also, but it was no worse than any other place I'd been. But upstate New York was different from El Paso, Texas, just the culture. El Paso was a place where it really did seem like it was colorblind. But that hit me hard in upstate New York, where West Point was.
How did it hit you hard?
It was just, everything from socialization, dances, where I was in El Paso, Texas, everybody would dance with you, ask them to dance. But I noticed that most of the dances, the girls were white. No big deal, but they would, for the most part, refuse to dance. And then, a white cadet would ask them, a fellow classmate, and they would dance. So it got to the point where, it was pretty frustrating. Many of us as cadets of color, we then organized our own dances and then started canvassing the area. First, it was 50 miles, 60 miles, and 100 mile radius of different colleges and women of color who, would socialize with us. And of course, Caucasians were certainly invited, but it was something that we needed to do. So I became one of those organizers that did that.
You graduated from West Point in 81. Did you have role models at that time? Did you have instructors who you looked up to?
I really did. And West Point had really made an effort to bring in a quality staff, both civilians and military. But of the different people I interacted with, the vast majority were Caucasian officers, many of whom would become general officers, but also African-American officers. There are at least seven, which is, again, unbelievable. Seven of the captains and majors I interacted with at West Point who were African-American became general officers themselves. General Ellis became a four-star general, the forces commander for the entire Army. Another Captain Kip Ward became General Kip Ward. He became the four-star general in charge of AFRICOM. So really had some quality role models there at that particular time at West Point.
We're talking about race in the military, what diversity and inclusion means in the branches of service. Retired Major General Dana Pittard is our guide. He co-authored the book Hunting the Caliphate, which tells a story of the initial fight against ISIS in Iraq in 2014. How do you feel about the military being sent in to deal with protesters in the Black Lives Matter movement? Did you serve in the Army or the Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines, Navy? What was your experience? Were you accepted? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing race in the military here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Air Force's new chief of staff, General C.Q. Brown Jr., became the first African-American general to lead a branch of the U.S. military. He reflected on this moment by saying he can't fix centuries of racism in our country, nor can he fix decades of discrimination.
I'm thinking about how I can make improvements. personally, professionally, and institutionally, so that all airmen, both today and tomorrow, appreciate the value of diversity and can serve in an environment where they can reach their full potential.
Are you in the military or retired? What was your experience like? Did you encounter instances of hatred? Were you passed over for promotion? Do you think this was due to racial bias? How could the military do better? It's 800-642-1234. We have retired Army Major General Dana Pittard, our guide. And during his career, he served four tours in Iraq and was commanding general of Fort Bliss in Texas. Major General, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on seeing General C.Q. Brown Jr. take over the Air Force.
Oh, yeah. And please call me Dana. I knew C.Q. Brown. We served together in the Middle East. And, of course, he went to Texas Tech and had a lot of friends in common there when he went through the ROTC program at Texas Tech. I'm from El Paso. It's a milestone event. I'm sorry it's taking so long for us to have the first African-American head of a individual service. Obviously, there was General Colin Powell, who was Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is overall services. But for a particular branch of service, General C.Q. Brown was the first to do that.
And as he took over, he immediately kind of got things out there, because he said these comments in June, and this is when protests are happening straight across the country for George Floyd. And he iterated again and again about what was on his mind. What do you make of that, in having this general speak very openly and candidly about race in the military?
I think you have to, because it is in fact a reality. I'm amazed to run into fellow former Army colleagues and classmates at West Point who said, "Well, I just wasn't aware." It's like, okay, because we don't talk enough about it, and that's one way we can end this legacy of systemic racism. I mean, I know people who can't stand the term systemic racism who are Caucasian, but unfortunately, there is a legacy of that in our country, and it's still there. So I applaud General C.Q. Brown for talking about it.
What are some instances that you see that you've encountered when you joined the Army that stuck with you in your more than 30-year career, that were on your mind as you made decisions about your job, while you made decisions on your interactions with your fellow troops?
Well, I guess number one is certainly leading in combat. I can honestly say it never really crossed my mind, because again, you're focused. You're focused on working as a team. So I think only one time in a combat zone did it ever even really cross my mind. And that's when I was visiting Fallujah. I was a brigadier general at the time, one-star general. And I heard a Marine three-star general make an off-color joke to a group. And I was talking with a small group, and he was talking with a small group, and he was talking about cornering an insurgent on a previous tour in Iraq. He said, "Yeah, we had him cornered, and he was so scared. It was like a coon in a Klan meeting." And I thought, I hadn't heard that term coon since I was in elementary school. So that's the only time I think that in a combat zone I heard that, but. Obviously,
did you confront him at all? Did you talk with him?
I walked toward him at that point. First of all, I said, "What?" And then a Marine one-star who I was talking to held me back a little bit and said, "He didn't mean to. He's single. He doesn't have a wife to help filter his comments." I said, "Okay, we're in Fallujah. I don't understand." And unfortunately, at that point, because it was the end of a ceremony, my aide-de-camp came up and said, "Sir, the helicopter's waiting. They're waiting on you." And it wasn't my helicopter, so I had to go. But you know, he just exchanged looks. I never forgot that. And then I walked out.
We're talking with retired Major General Dana Pittard, spent more than three decades in the Army before retiring in 2015. We're talking about race in the military, taking your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jean now, joining us from the town of Poygan. Hi, Jean. Jean, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I'm here.
Great. Jean, go ahead.
Good morning. My father's experience in the military in Korea shaped his views. He had grown up prejudiced and bigoted. And in the Army, he was confronted with integration and soon came to understand that it didn't matter what color a person's skin is. He, on returning to the U.S., he became active in the civil rights movement, and his values on equality were passed down to my brother and me and his grandchildren. It shaped generations, his experience in the military.
Wow, interesting story to bring to the table, Jean. What are your thoughts there, Dana?
Well, I think that's wonderful, and that's one of the beauties, I think, of the U.S. military is that it has, in many ways, led the way as far as socialization and integration in our society in many ways. And you see some of the same effects, but not quite the same effect, but on sports teams. I think the more that you interact with people that are different from you, the more open and more understanding that you may have. Of course, it may work both ways, but I think that's a wonderful story.
You've also said, though, as long as there is racism in our society, there will be racism inside the military. Can you parse that out for us?
Sure, because the people in the military come from our society. And as much as the Army can say, we won't allow discrimination, that's true. But you can't stop what's in people's hearts, and the unconscious bias comes out, and implicit and unconscious bias can come out, and it shows, and that's something that we've got to do more on. It can't just be that we don't discriminate. It should be that we are trying to turn our leaders into anti-racists, not just people who tolerate, but into anti-racists, which is a step further.
Let's bring in Ryan now in DeSoto. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
So I grew up in an Air Force enlisted family. My father served 27 years, and I mean, I have a grandfather who served in the Army as an officer. And everything that we grew up, me and my brothers, that is, everything that we always heard from my dad was, if you see a uniform, it's not a person, it's family. And we, he was part of the NCO club at the time, and I probably had an extra 10 adopted dads just because he was so close with all of them. And we saw them all the time. So I never really grew up seeing skin color. I saw a uniform.
What impression does that make on you now, Ryan, when you look to our military?
Hearing that there's, the possible or there is racial injustice, it's not fair. I think the military is making good steps to change it with the anonymous promotion boards now that I've read about. But at the same time, I don't think it should have had to go that far. I think it should always have been equal based on merit.
Ryan, thank you for bringing that. The first thing Ryan was saying there was about, wearing the military uniform, and that helps how he views people who wear the uniform. Can you comment on that, Dana?
Oh, sure. And I appreciate Ryan even sharing that story, and very thankful for the service of his father and his grandfather over the years. I know that as a military brat growing up, or military child growing up, was taught something very similar, which is, you know, the military overall is a family. And you had to be that way, because when you move from base to base, you had to quickly make friends, and people accepted you. So it really was a wonderful community. Unfortunately, that's also an artificial community. Once you go outside the gate of the base, it's just not quite like that. But yes, seeing someone in uniform, it's like it's someone who's related to you in some way. Kinship, I would say.
We're talking with Dana Pittard, retired Major General, our guide as we discuss race in the armed forces, the bigger picture of a systemic racism in our country. Did you leave the military because you felt like you weren't being treated fairly? Can you talk about the incident that drove you away from serving? How do you feel about military units controlling Black Lives Matter protesters? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back, picked up this discussion in right after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're spending the hour on race in the military. We're learning that racism continues to plague the military just as it plagues our society as a whole. But could the military be changing? Could there be changes to unconscious bias training, to implicit bias? Where do you see openings? We're spending the hour on the history, the culture of the U.S. military, where roughly 43% of the 1.3 million men and women who are active duty military are people of color. Taking your questions, your stories about the role of racism and what has happened in the military branches, it's 800-642-1234. We have retired Major General Dana Pittard as our guide. He spent 34 years in the Army before retiring in 2015. He was most recently commanding general of Fort Bliss in Texas. Before the break, Dana, we had heard from Ryan describing his view of someone in uniform as family and not viewing them by their race. Is it important, though, for soldiers to view each other's race and distinguishing the differences of their experiences that have come before active duty?
Yes and no. And that we should all look at each other as fellow soldiers, fellow airmen, fellow Marines, fellow sailors first. But we should also recognize where people have come from and the influences upon them, as well as the impacts of when you leave the base, especially in the past, not so much today, but certainly in the past, when you served on the Army post or base in the South. When you left the gate, it was a whole different story, the gate of the base. So that understanding, you know, hopefully one day we can just be a colorless society, but we must recognize and celebrate our differences.
Let's bring in Daryl now in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. Sure. I just had a comment. I see racism as not only a systemic problem, but more importantly, a subliminal American problem we all carry in our hearts and minds. We are all taught this by our parents, teachers, and political leaders. When I was in the Air Force, I guess because we all wore and wear the same uniform, which brought us together, you know, like was said earlier. But I believe if we, the people, all referred to ourselves as Native American, we would have a better chance of coming together under one flag. If you consider, if you ask people their ethnicity, they'll say something like, oh, I'm English American, Irish American, German American, or African American, etc. Why don't we, the people, refer to ourselves as American English, American Irish, American German, or American African? Do you see my point? It's subliminal.
And let's get Dana's thoughts on that in terms of ethnicity and how we refer to ourselves.
Actually, I like that. I like the idea of putting America first. I think that's a neat concept, and maybe one day we can get there.
I'm wondering, Dana, in terms of building a base, and you were commanding general of Fort Bliss, an enormous base. You also have to build a culture within that base and what it feels to live on that base. How did you try to make a culture that was inclusive, that would help the families and maybe build more community on base, regardless of what was happening off base?
Sure. I mean, it starts, I think, with leadership. Leadership that cares about, the service members, their families, the civilians who are on post, but also reaching out to the community outside. Now, Fort Bliss, very unique. It's the third largest Army post in the country as far as population, only behind Fort Bragg and Fort Hood. And in size, geographical area, it is the largest with 1.2 million acres. But also with Fort Bliss, we had the largest city outside of a troop installation in El Paso. El Paso, around 750,000 people. It's the largest city outside of an Army post where there are troop units. So that was unique. And the fact that I was from El Paso, so we already had a tie to the community because it was like two steps from almost anybody, the mayor and everybody else in El Paso. So we did a lot of community outreach, which was natural, making people on post feel like they're a part of the El Paso community. So that's important. But fostering diversity and inclusion, you have to live it. You can't just talk about it. You have to live it. We celebrated diversity, different months. There was African American History Month. There was Asian Pacific American Month, Women's History Month. But then you have to show throughout the leadership, and it goes all the way down to, young squad leaders being as fair as possible. That the test for that was when we really were trying to, it was a campaign to prevent accidental deaths, which included suicide. And so that was trying to change the culture that people would want to go to mental health facilities and behavioral health specialists for care. So that was part of our challenge in changing the culture. But that also included diversity and inclusion because you had to care and show you cared. So I think that all was very helpful.
I lived in a base town for 15 years, nearly Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And what I noticed, too, among my friends who were in the Air Force, that what made them stronger was, and also what tested their abilities, was all of the deployments. And I'm wondering, when those deployments happen, where do you see the relationships change and how people view race? Because when you're deployed, you're in a whole different world. It can be extremely stressful. And the world that is you've left behind could be vastly different.
Yeah, deployments, especially combat deployments, but operational deployments, when I saw racism, it wasn't there. I think it's because you had to depend upon each other. And families in the rear also had to stick together. So deployment is a different time period. And I think since 9/11, with so many deployments in our military, it certainly brought people closer together, certainly in combat. But you can't always be in combat, but it certainly made a difference as far as the closeness of the communities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dana Pittard, a retired major general in the Army, and we're talking about racism in the military and where we go from here with your insights, your experiences at 800-642-1234. What historical context should inform how we should think about race in the military today? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Dana, let's look at advancement in the military and the ability to move up in the military. What we see in the upper ranks of the armed forces does not reflect the number of men and women who are people of color. What is happening there?
I would agree to an extent. But I would tell you, I think it's better, much better than corporate America. I'm currently in corporate America. I'm vice president of a manufacturing company in Indianapolis, a global manufacturing company. There is a stark difference. At least in many ways, the military recognizes it and is trying to do something about it. I've been critical that, you know, the Army, we have one African-American four-star general out of 11 total. Out of 300 and some odd generals in the Army, 43 are African-American, which is pretty dang good. If you look at 300 CEOs in America, how many of them are African-American? Of the Fortune 500, I think the number is 5 or less. Mm. Yes, the Army and the military still have a ways to go, but they have done a lot, and they're ahead of the rest of society, at least, the corporate America.
In the mid-80s, you encountered, though, a commanding officer who was holding you back professionally while giving others more opportunities, other white soldiers of the same rank. What happened there? What did you do?
Oh, yeah. If there was a fascinating, case study, it might have been when I arrived at the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment in Germany, which was an elite armored cavalry unit that patrolled the West German, East German border. And there wasn't a whole lot of room for error there. It was a really great organization. Prior to arriving in Germany, or when I arrived in Germany, I arrived at Frankfurt Airport. Well, I had a classmate from West Point who also arrived the same time. And he had just transferred to armor and armored cavalry from being air defense. So he really didn't have any experience at all in armor. So in our bus ride to the unit, we had about 2.5 hours of talk, and I was telling them, well, I'll assist them, I'll help them, you know, learn tank gunnery and things like that you had to understand. Well, we both arrived again at the same time. He was seen first, no big deal. We were both outside of our squadron commander's office, and this was Ford near the East German border, and he was in there probably about 30-45 minutes, and squadron commander walked out with his arm around him and said, "You'll take command of H Company in our organization. You'll start your change of command inventory really soon." Well, again, taking command of a unit as a captain is a big deal. That's how you progress, is successful command. I thought, well, heck, he got a command. Maybe I'll get a cavalry troop because I'm very experienced. It was very good. Mm. Then he went back in his office. Well, his secretary outside his office looked at me and looked at the door. I was kind of embarrassed, awkward. She walked in the office and said, "Hey, sir, there's a Captain Pitard outside." And he said, "Oh, okay." Then he came to his door. He didn't allow me in his office.
We have to pause right there, okay. And we'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with retired Major General Dana Pitard. During his 34 years of service, he fought in Iraq and was awarded 4 Bronze Stars. Before the break there, you were talking about that moment in the 80s with that commanding general being outside his office. What happened?
Yeah, I didn't mean to go too far with that, but once his secretary went in and said, "Hey, there's another captain outside, Captain Pitard," and he came to his the edge of his door in his office, didn't allow me in, and said, "Oh, you're going to go down to the logistics shop. It's S4, and you'll be my assistant S4. And I had a little gumption back then, and it still do, and said, "Well, sir, isn't the S4 a lieutenant? You know, I'm a captain." He said, "Well, He's a dang good lieutenant, and you can learn a lot from him." So, okay. So I ended up being under lieutenant really for 6 weeks. which was unheard of. And then I watched captains come into the unit and get commands constantly. And at that point, right within 6 months, I wrote back to my new bride, who was teaching back in Kansas, who was coming over to Germany, that I decided to I would resign from the Army. This was 1986. But the difference was made by one person in leadership, and that's, we got a new regimental commander. The squadron commander left, and the new regimental commander, who was in charge of all the entire 11th Army Cavalry Regiment, asked a question, which was, why isn't Captain Batard get a command? You know, and I hadn't complained. I was just decided I was going to resign. The new squadron commander said, well, we're still looking at him, still testing him out. And the regimental commander then said, I want him slated for a command. Give him a shot. That's all I needed. That's all anyone needs. Don't need any special treatment, just a level playing field. Well, roll the tape forward now 4 years later. Now it's 1990. I've now had three straight successful commands in Europe. I was selected as the MacArthur Leadership Award winner, again, out of 300,000 troops there in Europe, 10,000 eligible junior officers like myself. And as General Shalikashvili, the commander of Europe, four-star general, is pinning a chest to my medal, asked if I wanted to say anything. And I said yes, which was, it is just too bad that 4 years ago, at this particular squadron commander in 11th ACR, he had a talented team, but he couldn't get past my color. And that just speaks volumes as far as when you're putting together a team, get as many of your players, your best players in there. You got to get beyond your natural bias. And I just said that was just too bad. He couldn't see past my color.
Are you worried at all about the number of military men and women who might have just resigned at that moment, who are not getting that break, if you will, that equal, that chance?
Oh, yeah. And it's more than just like African-Americans. It's women who've run into a glass ceiling. It's LGBTQ individuals. It's all sorts of people. We just have to get better. The military is better than, I think, society in general. But we as a society must get better. That's why we've got to end, you know, the whole legacy of systemic racism. Systemic racism itself may have ended, but the legacy is still there. So we have a lot of work to do. And from the callers and who have called in, I'm kind of inspired and encouraged that there's some really good people out there who can make a difference. It's going to take the entire society. It's going to take more than black people.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dana Petard, retired Major General in the U.S. Army, spent 34 years in service before retiring in 2015. Let's take another call now. Pete is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Pete.
Hi there. I am traveling down I-94 here in Milwaukee. There are a couple of short dead spots, so hopefully I'll get this out. But I'm an 18-year member of the Air Force Auxiliary, commonly known as Civil Air Patrol. We are a civilian asset, part of the Air Force. We are considered part of the total forces, but the squadron I belong to, it's called a composite squadron because it has cadets in it from ages 12 to 18. We have about 60 cadets, and we're considered one of the most diverse in the state, if not in the country. However, saying that, I guess I just preface it so I have a connection to the general here. I can take orders and follow orders, but that doesn't change my heart. The heart is formed in the home, and you know, following an order doesn't change my heart. So I not that I'm disagreeing, but I think it doesn't need to come or shouldn't just come from the top. We got to figure out how to get this done in the home. Because that is where, you know, I mean, you're going to follow your heart. Your heart goes where it wills. But again, your heart is formed in the home. So, again, the military is the great equalizer. But just following orders won't change hearts.
Pete, thank you for bringing that. And Dana, what do you make of that in terms of how you get people to look and change their worldview.
Sure. And I appreciate Pete and his service with the Civil Air Patrol. You know, our very first caller, the lady mentioned that her father was a bigot, was prejudiced coming out of his home, basically, until he joined the military. So it starts with a home, but you can still help to influence behavior by helping people see everyone as being a part of the team. And what I call anti-racist training, making people understand their own biases, because everybody has biases. In fact, there are, you know, there's no corn on the market for bigotry with Caucasians. I mean, all races have them. I mean, there's black bigots, there's Asian bigots. So making people aware of their biases, and then as a part of anti-racist training, helping them to deal with it will be important. But yeah, you can't order someone to change their heart. It does take time, and I think some training.
Should new members of the military have anti-racism training involved in boot camp, and what would that look like?
Absolutely should. And it's the idea of having, these case studies and having the discussions among people, even taking the that short test out of Harvard that helps you understand your own biases. We talked about this at one time for West Point. That is it good enough for West Point as a, you know, almost like a leadership factory, leadership academy, just to graduate good leaders? Well, no, they should be leaders who are also anti-racist, that it's more than just duty honor country. Duty honor country and not being biased or not being racist. Again, everybody has biases, but you can end racism in many ways by training people with anti-racist training. That can certainly help.
In our last minute together, what advice would you give to young enlistees, young soldiers of color entering the armed forces, about to change their lives?
Yes. Well, first of all, that America is worth serving. We are the greatest country in the world. And that's not just nationalism speaking. I've been to 85 different countries around the world, hope to get to 100. But we have something special here in America. And it's worth fighting for, and it's worth serving. And there are so many people who have served before them, whose shoulders they are standing on. And so I applaud anyone who wants to serve.
In the last few moments with us, how could the military do better tomorrow? What could change inside the military that might help improve race relations?
I think some things that we're already seeing. The chief of staff of the Army called me just a couple weeks ago. He's an old friend, and let me know what they were doing. And it's more listening, first of all, listening to the people, listening to what they have to go through. And then based on that listening, then coming up with plans of action. But it will not be solved overnight. Like growing a squadron commander in the Air Force or battalion commander in the Army, Marine Corps, takes 20 years. So it's training, it's anti-racist behavior, and it's monitoring and making sure that the Army realizes that there is implicit and unconscious bias there.
Well,
and that's
Dana,
something we gotta do too.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate.
Dana Pittard, retired Major General in the U.S. Army. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.